Session number 12707, Captain Frank Brewis, Reel 13.
Captain ACF Brewis, Reel 13. You mentioned earlier, Captain, the gunnery shooting that you had to do.
Oh, yes, up at Allendale.
Can you talk about the technique of gunnery in a tank?
Well, they were called classification courses. And basically, it was to give the gunners some live firing practice, and also to get to know their guns, because whatever the crosswires might be on, and in this case fixed targets at a known distance, so technically when the crosswires were on it with a good gunner who could traverse accurately onto the target, who could work out the elevation for the range, technically that HE shot should shatter the target. Most likely the fall of shot would be, even if it was on the right range, it might be to right or left of where he had his crosswire centered. So there could be something about that particular gun that had to be borne in mind by anybody who fired it. And the gunner had to know from observing the fall of shot, and the tank commander, of course, as well. But it was the gunner who was going to press the tit and send the shot off. He had to know that gun was in the habit of firing high and left or low and right, and to compensate for it. It's at this stage not learning how to try and maintain the gun level and in the right direction when the tank was bucketing about across country. The later Shermans, the gun was gyroscopically controlled, or in theory it was gyroscopically controlled. It did more or less keep the gun on an even keel when the tank was going over roughish ground, but I'm using roughish more or less in the golf course sense. I don't mean pitching in the ditches and coming out of them, because obviously at some stage the gun's going to be pointing at the sky, gyroscopes or not. But as well as aiming for elevation, you had a power traverse. There were a toothed ring on the main body of the tank, and a corresponding mating toothed ring on the turret. And you had a hand grip, left hand for the gunner, which turned anti-clock or clock within a limited traverse. And that turned the turret electrically. And it was getting to know not just firing at Allendale with a fixed target at a known distance, with the tank stationary, the turret stationary. The first practice was to have the turret off target and getting used to bringing the gun into line with the power traverse, and getting to know when you had to bring it back to the neutral position, because obviously with the weight of the turret and the tank, it didn't stop instantaneously. And it was not much good if you were offered 45 degrees and you started swinging it round, and of course the more you turned it, the faster it turned. So in an emergency, in action, it would need to be done quickly, but it's no damn good swinging it quickly, going past the target, and then have to start again, and then maybe go past it again. And if the electrics were out of order, then there was a hand traverse on a wheel. So it's not only the sighting and the firing and the loader firing according to the tank commander's orders, whether it was the Pisa he wanted the machine gun firing, or the main armament, or whether he wanted solid shot armor piercing, or whether he wanted HE. These courses at Allendale were to get all this second nature for the gunners, and to give the other members of the tank crew some experience as well. There's a bit more to it technically, but that's the sort of basis as I remember it.
Was the loader a separate person in the tank, or did the gunner also do the loading?
No. If you can imagine, within the Churchill, you had stacks of room. But imagine that you're in a turret facing forward. You've got to put this dirty great lump of iron in the middle. And a guard coming back and stopping just short of the wireless set at the back of the turret. A guard which is formed of four rods, you know, just slightly wider than the breech of the gun, and a metal shield at the back for the recoil. And obviously with a 6-pounder, which we now had on these Churchills, the greater space is taken up by the gun, and after all, that's the be-all and end-all of being there. And it's got a longer recoil. The shells are bigger. The shell cases are much longer. And when you get onto the Shermans with 75mm stuff, then there's not a heck of a lot of room to start slinging those about. And to get rid of the shell cases, which would be what? Shell case itself would be about 18 inches long. And about 3.5-4 inches diameter at the base. At the base. But you've got the gunner sitting on the left of the gun on his stool with his periscope, and he's got the Pisa 303 machine gun and the 6-pounder on the right. Of the gun is the loader wireless operator. So he's got two jobs. And the ammunition is in vertically in racks around his side and partly around the back, and spare ammunition over that side. The gunner has his own periscope and his sighting telescope. The tank commander, if he's got the flaps open and head out of the tank, then he's standing on, what height would it be? Not high enough if he's a short tank commander, and probably exposing too much of him if he's tall. But a stepped platform, foot or so above the turret floor. And closed down, then obviously he's on the tank floor, and he's got his own periscope on the cupola. Later ones, I don't know whether I'm getting mixed up with German tanks or our later ones, where there was a cupola ring. What am I thinking of? A cupola ring with several periscopes around it. But of course, imagine this and the gun firing. Somebody on the squawk box. The driver is turning his tank to the left. The gunner is turning his turret to the right. You're turning your cupola periscope to the left and round and behind. And it's a bit disorientating, to say the least. But it's got to be learnt. It's got to be learnt.
Where's the driver?
The driver is down in the depths. But he's got a mate with him in the Churchill. And it could be a howitzer in some marks, and he's co-driver and gunner for that gun. Or it could be another machine gun. In the Crocodiles, it was the fellow who operated the flamethrower who was the co-driver. And in the Churchill, you had a tiller bar steering with two drop, a sort of vertical bicycle handlebar, more or less. And he got his rev counter there, and usual brake, clutch, brake, accelerator, and because there's a hell of a racket going on from the engine, apart from anything racket that may be going on outside, he's got to watch the rev counter for when he changes gear. Otherwise, some rather crunchy sounds emanate from the back, generally above all other sounds that may be going on, and he probably gets a kick in the kidneys from somebody in the turret and said, for God's sake, sort them out, Jack.
The petrol or the fuel, where was it in the tank?
On the rear. Spare tank in fresh air on the rear, if I remember rightly.
What was the most vulnerable place for a tank to be hit?
Turret ring, I would say. It's heavy and it's locked in, but I talked about the toothed ring on which the turret turns. That if the turret's jammed, you're virtually useless as a fighting machine. Where the gun comes out of the turret, there's a recess in the armour. And although there's a curved shield on the gun, when it's in various positions, in sunlight, there's a dark shadow. And it's a very good aiming point for enemy gunners. And while it may not penetrate the armour, you can get a lot of splash inside the turret from that.
And what is splash?
Fragmented metal from the shell finding its way in through where the gun actually comes through the turret. apart from the fact that particularly later on, when hollow charge ammunition was invented by the Germans first, I think, the solid shot would hit the armour, not penetrate, but you would get splash or splatter fragments of metal flying around the turret from the inside of the armour, from the impact. The hollow charge one, again, I don't know how it worked, but it within the casing, there was a curved space, and it was not just solid shot. The nose cone would bury itself in the armour, and then a further charge, you know, virtually instantaneous, the charge would be able to take advantage of the fact that the armour had already been damaged from the impact, and this charge would just blast a hole through, and then of course everything was flying round the turret. On the glassy plate, which is the heavily armoured front plate, in some tanks more than others, they were steeply angled to deflect shot. But of course, to put a tank out of action quickly, the shot that smashed a track made it helpless. Thing about the Churchill with these multitudinous bogies, they were so close together that if a shot blew one or two of them out, it didn't disable the tank. It could still be mobile. But of course, if the track itself was split, well, the tank just starts to turn in a circle. And while you might be able to get out of it, if it's broadside on to wherever the muck's coming from, then you could probably get the odd spare plate on. But they weighed 56 pounds each, and they were slung around as extra armour in various parts of the tank.
The armour on tanks was not the same thickness all the way around?
No. No,
where was the thickest portion?
The glassy plate on the front. Of course, you see the idler wheel, the idler toothed wheel on the front of the tracks, or the sprocket wheel, the driving wheel on the back of the tank. They were equally vulnerable. Obviously, the turret was heavily armoured, and by its shape. Some turrets were cast, others were welded, others were a mixture of the two. The sides of the Churchill were heavily armoured. Those escape hatches, in most cases, the early ones, they were square. They were about 3 or 4 inches thick. Later on, they had circular escape hatches. Because they had to be liftable, the engine and gearbox compartment covers, which were horizontal, they had to be liftable for access. They were pretty heavy, but much thinner than other parts of the tank. The belly plate was a vulnerable spot. If you were climbing an obstacle and pointing everything to the sky, quite obviously, to be mobile over bad country, or to get up any speed, although speed with a Churchill was fast walking pace, more or less, that had to be a compromise between practicalities and vulnerability. You usually weren't turning your backside towards the enemy, unless you'd really run in a full circle with a broken track or a broken sprocket or something. So the rear of the tank would be a place where weight could be saved. But we're talking in terms of the Churchill of what? 38, 40 tons. It varied from one mark to another. Obviously, it was more when it got the bigger guns, and its operational weight was more. Obviously, you couldn't carry the same number of HE or solid shot with a 75 millimeter so long with a 2 pounder a quarter of the size.
What was the average number of shell that you could carry for use?
Oh, you've got me there. Oh, try and visualize the ammunition racks in a Churchill. Six-pounder. I might be over the top if I say 36. Round about that, I would think, now. 75-pounder in a Sherman. Maybe about 30. I'm very vague about that now. Whatever number it was, you could soon poop them off, and you were very much dependent on good blokes to replenish ammunition supply.
The Churchill, was it a reliable running machine?
Well, apart from when the two fitters found some more final drives gone west. In the early stages, Vauxhall put out a statement saying that it was a good tank, it was well designed, but from drawing board to finished product, production was the aim. They had to, on Churchill's orders, they had to get tanks into the hands of the armoured units. And they would, of necessity, find teething troubles. And it was through experience. And experience, as I recall, quickly gained. We had an engineer from Vauxhall came and lived with us. He slept and he ate with us, and he could report back direct to Luton anything that this particular unit, 155 RAC, had found that ABC could be not only reporting what had gone wrong, but he, with his expertise and that he'd gained in a hurry, there were Vauxhall engines, big twin, what was it, 350 horsepower, from some of their biggest trucks. But the gearing for driving the sprockets and all the great long linkage from the back of the tank to the driver sitting at the front. There were so many things that could go wrong. And, some of the fitters needed to be a left-handed gorilla to reach into some of the bits, because there were They were opposed, flat, what was the term for them? Horizontally opposed engines, so that the plugs and everything were at the sides, weighed down among all sorts of cables and this, that, and the other, and not far from the armoured skin on either side. And you're complicated with the cooling systems and more pipes than a church organ. With the grants and the lees, it was a fitter's dream, but a crew's nightmare, because they were radial engines. And to start them up, I mean, you hadn't to be in a hurry to get to a battle. You had to wind them up by hand, what was it, about 50 times, because the lower pots in the circle, you know, it was an upside down, or next to upside down cylinder, and there was bound to be some oil seepage past the cylinder down towards the plugs, which in this case were now at the bottom. And if you tried to start it up, well, you'd just blow the tops off those pots that had oil in. So you had to wind them up and get them cleared. And you had the disadvantage from a fighting tank point of view was that it was high. I can later talk about the gunnery side of it, but from the, we're talking about tank maintenance and the job of fitters. You had two fair-sized square doors, about 2 foot six square, the rear of the tank, and you opened doors, and the engine was mounted on rails. And the fitters brought up a trolley fitted with corresponding rails, and you undid this, that, and the other, about 50 different bits at the far end, and you pulled it out onto the trolley, and you took it away, and you put a new one back in, and you hooked up the plugs and the fuel connections and this, that, well, away you go. Mind they had a tendency to catch fire. But compared to the intricacies of the Churchill, where they had engines of specific size already in production that had to be slotted in to an armoured vehicle, and it was all new to them, and the final drive, the reduction, the gearboxes used to give a bit of bother. But whether that was due to drivers in training crashing them, it may be, but I think there were technicalities as well. It improved. I'll try and sort out for you another time just how many marks of Churchill there were by the end of the war.
You went off to the North Tyne area, I believe you said.
Oh, yeah.
What was the purpose of that?
Well, it was to get some better training ground. And to a large extent, it was not waste ground. There was sort of scrub land and running into moorland, and it was higher elevation. It wasn't as boggy. It also had an indirect morale effect. Not that morale was low. It was soaring. But up to then, it had been the troopers' horizon was a squadron. At Gunnerton, we came together as a regiment. It was a fair amount of rain, and we were all under canvas. But on the whole, we had some good weather, and we had a good naffy. We were a bit far from civilization It wasn't a, it was a tiny village, really. But the Passion Wagon used to run, well, certainly Saturday nights, probably two or three times a week, down into Hexham, where there would be dances at the Queen's Hall and cinema, and a fair sprinkling of pubs. Whether they had any beer regularly or not was another question. We had a very good regimental sports day, I remember. Brewis was a field events judge on that occasion. I wore a lot of different caps, but this one was quite a pleasure. We weren't there very long, and this was when it started to get a little bit out of the ordinary. The CO was away quite frequently.
You still have the same CO?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Colonel Heslop, Daddy Heslop. And there were occasions when all the senior officers, all the officers of field rank were away. And we couldn't get anything out of them.